Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today, I fancy talking a little bit about the Balfour Declaration. Not in small part, because I read two superb books on it. The Balfour Declaration by Jonathan Schneer, which looks really at the period of time from about 1914 to the Declaration in 1917. And James Barr's A Line in the Sand, which looks at Anglo-French relations over the Middle East from the First World War, all the way through to the 1950s. Both brilliant reads. The Barr book, perhaps a little more accessible, but the Schneer, packed with detail, brilliant scholarship, brilliant analysis. Anyway, after singing the praises of those two writers, let's talk a little bit about the Balfour Declaration. Okay, for those who aren't obviously scholars of 20th century Middle Eastern history, the Balfour Declaration was the letter sent from Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, in 1917 to Lord Rothschild, the real heart of the Jewish community in Britain. The most significant and wealthy Jewish socialite and financier living in Britain, announcing that the British Empire would support a Jewish homeland. They didn't use the word state, but a Jewish homeland in Palestine at the end of hostilities during World War One. So, how did this come about? Well, in 1914, Britain goes to war with Germany, but later in 1914, she also goes to war with Germany's now Ottoman ally. The Ottoman Empire had been through a series of fundamental changes in the previous decade. In 1908, the Young Turk movement, the revolutionary, nationalist and in some ways progressive modernist uprising, overthrew Sultan Abdul Hamid and declared a new state of affairs existing in the Ottoman Empire, a decidedly more anti-clerical, westernised, liberal and modernist movement. The kind of movement really that had shaped much of Europe 60 to 70 years beforehand, sweeping away ancien regimes throughout the 19th century. These were men who felt that it was time, Turkey's time to catch up, and the rest of the Ottoman empires as well. The empire had been in a state of fairly serious decline over the previous half century, and the First World War was looked as if it would present huge problems for the empire. The ruling triumvirate of pashas who had taken power after the overthrow of Sultan Abdul Hamid weren't completely decided amongst themselves whether going in on Germany's side was a particularly good idea. And the existence of a modern secular modernising leadership in Istanbul was, in certain parts of the empire, deeply unpopular. We only need to look at the reaction of Sharif Hussein of Mecca, who would later lead the Arab revolt against the Ottomans, to understand some of his motivations for doing that. The popular view that we get from David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia is that the Arabs are the oppressed peoples of the empire, which in some ways they were and in some ways they weren't, and they wished freedom. One of the motivations that the Sharif Hussein had was not so much to free his people in the classic formulation, but to actually rebel against the modernising instincts of the Young Turks. And it was certainly the intention of the Sharif Hussein and his sons to establish a very theocratic state once the war was won. Initially, they had their eyes on establishing a state in all of Arabia, in the Arabian Peninsula, and in the north in Palestine and Syria, and what is now Jordan and Iraq, really all the way up to Persia, which would have been a Sharia law fundamental Islamic state, and a rejection really of the modernism that was being proposed and implemented by the Young Turks. The British had sounded out the Sharif before the war, and before there was the prospect of facing the Ottoman Empire on the battlefield, as to the possibility, as to whether the Arabs would be useful allies, saboteurs, rebels, fifth columnists, what you will. Lord Kitchener, in point of fact, was the person who pursued this. And the matter was left as a kind of a possibility, a what-if, until obviously hostilities broke out. The Sharif seems to have had an unusually benign view of the British, an unusually trusting view of the British, and saw them as honourable gentlemen who would stick by their word. Eventually, the British come to disappoint the Arabs, but that's a story for later on. The British High Commissioner in Egypt, Sir Henry McMahon, and Sharif Hussein of Mecca exchanged a series of letters between 1915 and 1916, and the strong impression McMahon gives in the letters to the Arabs is that they will be able to have a large Arabic state once the Turks have been defeated, one that includes both Syria and Palestine. In roughly the same time period, Sir Mark Sykes, the British cabinet's Arab expert, conferred with his opposite number, Georges Picot, on the future of the Ottoman Empire once it had been defeated by the French and the British. And the decision that they eventually come to, outlined in the secretive Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, is that the British will gain access to Iraq and Transjordan, and the French will have a large Syria incorporating parts of southern Turkey, and they will create the state of Lebanon. Palestine was going to exist under an international mandate. It eventually, following the Paris Peace Conference, falls under a British mandate. When the Arabs eventually rebel against the Ottomans and attack them up along the western seaboard of Saudi Arabia, what is now Saudi Arabia, the kingdom of the Hejaz, all the way up to the Sinai, the British and the French had already made a deal between them which undermined the fundamental war aims and objectives of the Arabs. The chances of there being this enlarged Arab kingdom were now fairly minimal, and the prospects of a large Western intervention and presence in the Middle East for the foreseeable future were going to be there. The Arabs had no idea about this, but T.E. Lawrence, the British soldier and intellectual and desert warfare specialist, had every idea about this. And in the Jonathan Schneer history of the Balfour Declaration, it becomes very clear that Lawrence felt that the Arabs had been absolutely betrayed, and he felt terribly guilty on this matter. He knew that the men that he was with, that he admired, were fighting and dying for, in essence, for nothing. One reason that Schneer puts forward, which I find fascinating, for the needs to defeat the Ottomans was the fear amongst the British that the Germans might get a far greater foothold in the Ottoman Empire and might even use the Ottomans to encourage a revolt of Muslims worldwide, which would cover the 300 million or so that fell under the auspices of the British Empire. Another interesting aspect of the Balfour Declaration is the relationship between the British War Cabinet and Britain's Jews. And there was a sort of a rather unspoken anti-Semitism that existed that led the likes of Lloyd George particularly to believe that the Jews were the key to winning the war. In another excellent history on this particular subject, Tom Segev's One Palestine Complete, well worth a read if you can get your hands on it, the picture of a suspicion of the of world Jewry, which is a term which was used obviously by various establishment figures at the time. This is not a term I am, by the way, endorsing. Unless we kind of go down some horrible David Irving kind of tract. The suspicion of world Jewry was actually viewed by the War Cabinet as being a potential advantage, i.e. The war had reached a deadlock by 1915, and anything to break the deadlock was being entertained. And the belief that if somehow the world's Jews could be brought into the Allied camp, then they would work whatever mysterious conspiratorial magic they had in order to try to bring America into the war or bring American finance on the, more firmly onto the Allied side. And then following the Russian Revolution of 1917, which, you know, casual anti-Semites assumed was the work of the Jews. Again, having the Jews as an important ally would probably help keep Russia in the war. All this, of course, is total fantasy land when you look at the means available to the likes of Chaim Weizmann and the rest of the Zionists in Britain. These are comparatively impoverished and poorly connected people, and it's only through extremely talented political contact making that Weizmann manages towards the end of World War One to be taking tea briefly with Lloyd George. So there is no kind of, obviously, none of these kind of conspiracies outside the imagination, fertile imagination of certain journalists and writers. However, the fact that the British War Cabinet believed such things is actually more important than the rather less exciting reality. The fact that the British War Cabinet actually supposed that the Jews could, if they were appealed to, help the Allies is a very interesting fact. Perhaps this gives us an indication of the desperation of the Allied powers at the time to try to win the war. And it also gives us an indication of popular anti-Semitism. And these were ideas thought by people who consider themselves largely fairly tolerant and looked at the things like the pogroms of Tsarist Russia with horror. But making kind of casual references to the conspiratorial nature of Jews, that was basically okay. Anyway, the decision to grant a homeland to the Jews in the Middle East is, you know, not entirely born out of cynicism either. There was, from the likes of Arthur Balfour, who's this kind of enigmatic character who didn't really seem to be animated by very much at all, or passionate about very much, but suddenly finds the cause of Zionism a very important thing to pursue. There is some evidence of a genuine sense of mission, a genuine sense of that it was Christian duty to return the Jews to the land of Canaan, and to complete some kind of biblical destiny. There is a sense also that having a non-Arab state or a non-Arab peoples in the Middle East would do something to civilise what was largely seen by the Western Allies as a very backward and barbaric region. And there was a belief that hopefully the Arabs would see the industrious Jewish example and follow suit. You know, one only needs to look at other aspects of the British Empire to find other such kind of out there notions of and sense of mission and improvement and all this kind of thing. Interestingly, the Jewish community in Britain was far from united on the subject of establishing a mandate in Palestine or a national homeland for the Jews. There were a great many assimilationist Jews in Britain who felt that really they were British first and Jewish second, and that by creating a Jewish homeland, you were going to be wrecking the dreams of assimilated Jews around the world, and it would give an excuse to anti-Semites everywhere to say, there's your homeland, go to it, you're not welcome here anymore. Thus fulfilling making anti-Semitism and the exclusion of Jews in Europe a self-fulfilling prophecy. Ultimately, it's the Zionists in Britain who prevail. It's the Zionists who finally get the ear of the government and make the case to them for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. A case, as I've mentioned, their government wasn't entirely unsympathetic to in the first place. Anyway, now this is by no means an exhaustive history. It's very difficult. This is such a complicated matter to shoehorn this into less than 20 minutes, obviously. Obviously, is not going to do it justice. So I would urge you, if you are wanting to learn more about this, look at any of those three books that I've mentioned, The Line in the Sand, The Balfour Declaration, or One Palestine Complete, all three of which can give you a really rich understanding of this subject area. Anyway, I hope that's useful. If you've got exams coming up in the next few weeks, best of luck. I'll be thinking of you. And I've recorded further back on this podcast some great resources for people who are struggling with essays and that kind of thing. And there'll be a few more of those to come in the next few days or so. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.